cannot hide it anymore. They are exposed. And now the most important thing is that every complicit party has to know that they will be the next. Israel may escape with it, but the other complicit parties will not.
That gave me hope, and that reminded me that this is a long struggle. And even though a ceasefire has not been ordered, which is a bitter pill for us to swallow, but this is still a victory. This is the first time that Israel has been officially quite clearly reprimanded. And as Muin Rabbani, the Palestinian analyst, said, this is a stain on them forever.
Of Foreign Affairs on 6 December 2023.
The muted response to the ICJ's interim ruling shows that it wasn't just occupation Israel that was in the dock in the building behind me, but actually it was institutions like the ICJ, like the UN's top court, because people want to know that they can have justice that is tied to what's going on and not simply to Western political interests.
The European Union has said it respects the decision of the court and expects all parties to comply. Meanwhile, Israeli ministers have taken to social media to call out both the ICJ for attempting to lecture Tel Aviv and again calling the South African case anti-Semitic. South Africa, who brought the action against Israel to the ICJ, acknowledged the six measures granted would be difficult to implement without a ceasefire.
This case was very much about international bodies ensuring that they exercise their responsibility to protect us all as global citizens.
From the river to the sea!
Israel has 1 month to make its initial report to the ICJ to show compliance of the special measures requested. Palestinians have indicated they will not hold their breaths. Amina Taylor, The Hague.
In the limelight.
The turn of events in recent months amid the Zionist regime genocidal war on the Gaza Strip has demonstrated to the world the awe-inspiring bravery and heroism of the Yemeni government and its military. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Press TV wrote, "Identity from a political perspective refers to self-awareness in the mirror of interaction with others. This identity enables the basic political distinction between friends and enemies. According to this interpretation, political actors shape their foreign policy based on the friend-enemy dimension. First, we need to discuss the revolutionary nature of Iran. The fall of the Pahlavi regime in Iran, which had been in power from 1925 until 1979, and the subsequent victory and establishment of the Islamic Republic, marked the success of a revolutionary ideology vital for understanding the significance of the anti-colonial and anti-hegemonic vision upon which Iran bases its foreign policy. Due to this revolutionary ideology, resistance against those powers deemed hegemonic is considered a political military obligation." Another fundamental element to understanding the identity of the Islamic Republic is the Islamic dimension, which is the main element upon which the revolutionary ideology is based. It includes embracing the idea of Muslim unity propounded by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, and bringing the gap between Sunni and Shia. It includes embracing the idea of Muslim unity propounded by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, and bridging the gap between Sunni and Shia. In other words, the goal is to assert that Islam is a common language that enables Muslims to interact and debate among themselves. Another element is building a just society, which is an ethical political aspiration that lies at the heart of the Islamic ideology. It calls on Muslims to tirelessly struggle against oppression in all its forms. From the Islamic political perspective expressed by the Islamic Republic of Iran, it sees the world as a confrontation between justice and oppression. When defining the main factors that articulate the identity of Ansarullah, it is necessary to analyze the widespread idea that treats the group in a particular way and Yemen in a general sense as a tribal society based on ethnic diversity and without a national identity. This type of analysis assumes that the nation-state is a privileged element when defining and identifying political identities. From this kind of reductionism, it is not possible to understand either the Iranian Islamic identity or the political affinities between Ansarullah and the Islamic Republic. That being said, for Ansarullah, one of its historical identities is what the group refers to as an Arab identity. This identity, in turn, is mediated by Islamist discourse, a political discourse that allows for various articulations. It is precisely this Islamist discourse that explains the convergence between Iran and Ansarullah. The Yemeni group sees Islam as a discourse of liberation against colonial oppression, both internal and external, as well as against the presence of countries considered oppressors and aliens in the region. This political convergence highlights the inadequacy of explanations that seek to portray the collaboration between Tehran and Sana'a solely in terms of Shia religious affiliations. This essentialist reductionism fails to consider the political dimensions of Islam, understood as discourse. The political affinity between Ansarullah resistance movement and Iran becomes even more apparent when considering the revolutionary ideology of the Yemeni group. Since its origins in 1990s, the group has embraced the doctrine of Velayat-e-Faqih, or the system introduced by Imam Khomeini and its cornerstone of the current Islamic Republic as a political ethical guide for its actions in the political arena. In the post-9/11 era, and the so-called War on Terror by the U.S. regime, Ansarullah publicly expressed its anti-imperialism. Simultaneously, leaders of Ansarullah, such as Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi, further aligned ideologically with the Islamic Republic of Iran. In a speech in 2001, during the commemoration of Al-Quds Day, an annual event established by Imam Khomeini for the liberation of Quds, Houthi emphasized the path of resistance against oppression and identified the United States regime as the main enemy of the Yemeni people. In 2002, Al-Houthi himself introduced what has since become the group's slogan, "God is great, death to America, death to Israel, curse upon the Jews, victory for Islam." This slogan shares a discursive affinity with one of the most widely used slogans in Iran, "Marg bar America," translated as "death to America," actually meaning the American hegemony. Hence, it can be seen how Iran and Ansarullah express, in a shared Islamic tradition, the rejection of the naturalization of the presence of oppressive foreign forces in the region. Iranian officials have repeatedly asserted that the Yemeni government's actions in the Red Sea are not dictated by Tehran. It's a sovereign country that makes its own decisions.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Association for Israel Soldiers is based in occupied Palestine and claims to be the sole avenue through which donations can be made directly to IOF soldiers and IOF units. These donations come from Zionists in Palestine as well as from the US, Canada, Brazil, Mexico, France, and the UK. The UK Friends of the Association for the Well-being of Israel Soldiers is a registered charity which is obliged by law to show public benefit. Its charitable objectives include relief of need and suffering, advancement of education, and provision of facilities for recreation of the occupation forces. Guidance published by the Charity Commission states that it is a legal requirement that any detriment or harm that results from charitable purposes must not outweigh the benefit. Perhaps supporting genocide outweighs those purposes. Amongst the trustees of the charity are Colonel Richard Kemp, a former British soldier said to have hateful views on Islam and Muslims. In December, the BBC was criticised for interviewing Kemp without reference to his role as a UK Avis trustee. In one recent interview with a pro-Israel blog, Kemp was quoted as describing the killing of civilians in Gaza as necessary. Palestine Declassified has traced around 20 charities which have donated to UK Avis over the last 15 years. The following are notable donors: Gerald and Gail Ronson Family Foundation, which was created by Gerald Ronson, the convicted fraudster, who runs the Rontec company, operating over 250 BP and Esso service stations in the UK. Ronson also set up the Community Security Trust that runs point of the Zionist regime in the UK. Though one of its charitable objectives mentions opposing extremism, this is yet another example showing that Ronson, in reality, supports extremism and genocide. Loftus Charitable Trust, set up by the Loftus family, which made its money from the watchmaking firm Accurist. It also funds the extremist Zionist sect Shabbat Lebovich, Islamophobic think tanks, Jewish supremacist groups in East Jerusalem, and the Community Security Trust. David and Ruth Lewis Family Charitable Trust, set up by the Lewis family, which own River Island clothing chain. The charity also funds Islamophobic think tank and illegal settlements in East Jerusalem. The Family Foundations Trust, set up by the UK property investor Richard Mintz. The charity has funded the extremist sect Shabbat Lebovich, Islamophobic think tanks, and the Community Security Trust. Richard's son and charity trustee Joshua co-founded the website Friend a Soldier, an online platform where soldiers can become digital ambassadors. UK Avis is already under investigation by the UK charity regulator, the Charity Commission. The investigation should widen to include the nexus of genocide-supporting charities we have revealed. They should be shut down by the Charity Commission.
Since mid-November 2023, the Yemen-based Ansarullah movement has attacked dozens of commercial ships destined to the occupied territories. The ships were mostly attacked in the Red Sea. Yemeni officials say the attacks are a show of support for the Palestinian people in Gaza. The attacks have practically halted commercial activities in the port of Eilat in the occupied territories. They have also increased global commercial costs. The U.S. and U.K. have militarized the region with their strikes on Yemen. An exodus of shipping companies from the region now threatens to scuttle supply chains and increase consumer prices. More than 150 commercial ships have chosen the longer route since November. The Red Sea is one of the most important arteries in the global shipping system, with one-third of all container traffic flowing through it. Sustained disruption in trade there could send a ripple effect of higher costs throughout the world economy. This is particularly true of energy. 12% of seaborne oil and 8% of liquefied natural gas LNG transits the Suez Canal. Ships shunning the Red Sea will have to instead sail around the Horn of Africa, which can cost $1 million more round trip and additional fuel costs.
Gaza, where Israel's air and artillery strikes have become a regular occurrence. In the besieged strip, sounds of bombardment are followed by screams of mothers losing their kids, as well as cries of children whose parents are killed by the regime. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, most of them women and kids, have been killed in the relentless strikes since October 7th. Humanitarian organizations report that more than 10 children on average lose one or both of their legs per day in the coastal territory. And that's just one aspect of the unending cycle of Israel's brutality against the people of Gaza. Apart from casualties, the regime's recurring attacks have caused indescribable devastation in the Palestinian territory. But when it comes to describing the true nature of the Israeli onslaught, there's no word better than genocide. There are multiple reports and countless evidence indicating that what's taking place in Gaza meets the definition of a genocidal war. Since the very beginning of the onslaught, millions of people around the world, along with a number of states, have been calling on international institutions to oblige Israel to end the genocide. South Africa is one of those states. The country, in late December, filed a lawsuit against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Now, nearly 1 month after the lawsuit was filed, the Hague-based court is set to convene on Friday to decide on South Africa's request for an interim ruling in its genocide case against Israel. The possible verdict by the ICJ would order Israel to announce a ceasefire in Gaza and allow more humanitarian aid into the Palestinian territory. In its filing, Pretoria referred to Israel's violation of the United Nations 1948 Genocide Convention. South Africa's application includes multiple offenses, from indiscriminate killing of Palestinians to the wholesale destruction of Gaza's infrastructure. Earlier in January, the Hague-based court convened two-day hearings. At the closing of the first day, the South African ambassador to the Netherlands asked the court to order Israel to immediately suspend its onslaught on the besieged strip.
One, the state of Israel shall immediately suspend its military operations in and against Gaza. Two, the state of Israel shall ensure that any military or irregular armed units which may be directed, supported, or influenced by it, as well as any organizations and persons which may be subject to its control, direction, or influence, take no steps in furtherance of the military operations referred to in point one above.
South Africa's move has been welcomed by Palestinian resistance movements. Hamas said the arguments and evidence put forth by South Africa proves Israel's crimes of genocide and ethnic cleansing in Gaza. The Palestinian foreign ministry also applauded the move, calling it a historic moment for humanity.
This is a historical moment for the Palestinian people and for humanity, as well as for the world order based on law.
A number of countries and international organizations have welcomed South Africa's case at the ICJ. The Organization of Islamic Countries, OIC, and the Arab League expressed their support for the case. Malaysia, Turkey, Jordan, and Iran are among the states voicing support for the motion. Israel's crimes against Palestinians in Gaza have also been referred to the International Criminal Court. Mexico and Chile have requested the ICC to probe the crimes against civilians in Gaza. Submitting lawsuits at international courts are parts of global efforts to mandate Israel to put an end to its non-stop strikes on Gaza, as their scale and nature dovetail with the widely accepted narrative that the onslaught is actually a genocidal war.
South Africa has taken the step to invoke the Genocide Convention and charge Israel in the International Court of Justice. While there are severe limitations to this process, it is undeniably momentous to see Israel brought before the highest international court to answer for its crime of genocide against the Palestinians. The relationship between South Africa and Palestine is deep and cannot be underestimated. It was forged through oppression and racial subjugation. Israel was a key player in the development and later the malignancy of apartheid rule in South Africa. South Africa's apartheid Prime Minister Daniel Malan was the first foreign prime minister to visit Tel Aviv following the Nakba. Hendrik Verwoerd, a South African apartheid architect and prime minister, even claimed in 1961 that Israel, like South Africa, is an apartheid state. That was six decades before Amnesty International said the same. In order to improve the image of apartheid in South Africa, Israel and the apartheid authorities established a joint secretariat for political and psychological warfare in 1975. By 1981, the apartheid army in South Africa had 200 Israeli military advisors, and hundreds of apartheid troops were also educated in Israeli military academies. Israeli military instructors provided direct guidance to the South African Reconnaissance Commando's elite unit in particular. Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms business, played a key role in the development of South Africa's military electronics industry. South Africa's naval forces were also trained in Israel and sold radar systems by ELTA, a subsidiary of the state-owned Israeli Aerospace Industries. Israel was also essential to the construction of an electric wall to police the border of apartheid South Africa, with the crew of 50 Israeli technicians stationed permanently at the wall for maintenance. The Israelis also planted radar devices and minefields along the border. Israeli intelligence agencies had a steady presence in apartheid-era South Africa. The apartheid intelligence agency BOS ran a letterbomb campaign against ANC figures like Ruth First, which employed similar methods in its Operation Wrath of God against Palestinians in Lebanon. It is thought likely that Israel provided support for this. The Israel spy agency, the ADL, also spied on many anti-apartheid activists, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and sold the information to BOS agents of the apartheid regime in South Africa. Israel and apartheid South Africa worked closely on nuclear research, with South African uranium proving extremely useful to Israel's covert nuclear program. Are we witnessing the revenge of history?
Over 100 days into the U.S.-Israeli war on Gaza, over 100 days of death and destruction for a regime which indiscriminately targets any moving thing anywhere in the war-ridden strip, be it residential buildings, medics, journalists, hospitals, or schools, an all-out war against the Palestinian territory from air, sea, and land, killing over 25,000 people, most of them innocent women and children. The Israeli aggression has been repeatedly described as not just a war, but a genocide and an attempt at the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. The bloodthirsty regime, however, has failed to reach any of the goals it has stated to justify its ongoing bloodshed, annihilating Hamas, setting free scores of captives held in Gaza, and pushing Palestinians out of their ancestral lands. On the ground, Palestinian fighters have inflicted heavy losses, both on the regime's military hardware and on IOF troopers. Back in the occupied territories, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing growing domestic outrage over his failure in the war and in securing the release of nearly 130 captives held by Hamas, both from ordinary people.
On the morning of October 7th, this government and this Prime Minister totally failed us. After 107 days, we are demanding that they fix the failure.
And a widening rift within Israel's political and military establishment. Israeli cabinet minister and former military chief Gadi Eisenkot is only one of the Israeli officials that have recently dismissed any achievement in Gaza. Eisenkot says the military operation in Gaza has failed to bring the captives back, arguing that the only solution is a deal with Hamas.
That it's impossible in the near future to restore the hostages alive without a deal.
Eisenkot's words contradicts a previous statement by Benjamin Netanyahu that rejects conditions presented by Hamas to end the war and release captives that would include Israel's complete withdrawal and leaving Hamas in power in Gaza. Meanwhile, growing protests have been held on a weekly basis in Israel, calling on the regime to take action to secure the release of their loved ones. Such demands, however, have fallen on deaf ears. With the war in its fourth month now, public opinion has shifted further against Netanyahu, leading to louder calls for leadership changes and the possibility of an early election. In the coming days, a Knesset meeting will be held to discuss a no-confidence motion against the premier. The motion, submitted by the opposition Labour Party, accuses Netanyahu of failing to make necessary decisions to get the captives freed. As protests reverberate through a cabinet already rattled by massive demonstrations in 2023, the question looms: will Netanyahu heed the voices of the people, or will he prioritize his own political pursuit over their demands? Perhaps it will take a new election for the Israelis to make their voices heard, an early election that would topple the hard-right premier after over 16 years in office.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Palestinian people resort to extreme measures that have had adverse effects on their health due to intense Zionist regime bombing and food shortages. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. We'll be right back. Middle East Eye Roads, Palestinians in Gaza have been forced to resort to extreme measures amid growing starvation as a result of Israel's relentless bombardment and a full siege imposed since October. Many families across the besieged enclave had to mix various ingredients into flour to make bread using traditional methods due to the scarcity of food. Families have been forced to use animal fodder and bird feed baked into their bread, sometimes causing medical problems, particularly in young children. Abu Ala, an owner of a mill in central Gaza, said that the food available to people is indelible. He told Middle East Eye, "Something should be done about this urgently. People are mixing bird feed and animal food into their bread. This is not right. It's not healthy. People are grinding this and mixing it into their bread." He explained that this is happening due to a lack of aid deliveries as well as the sharp skyrocketing prices of goods that are available. Abu Ala says that he has been forced to reduce the price of wheat due to the dire circumstances, despite rising costs hitting everyone. Families wait in line for hours every day to get just a few pounds of flour. However, often, by the time families get to the front of the queue, the flour would have already run out. Meanwhile, on many occasions, people are forced to scatter due to the Zionist regime's bombardment. According to a report by the UN in December, 93% of the people in Gaza are facing crisis levels of hunger, and a quarter of the population of the Gaza Strip faces catastrophic hunger and starvation. Recently, the World Food Programme, WFP, said in a statement that the entire population is acutely food insecure. More than a quarter of them, 500,000 people, are at IPC5, the most extreme stage of hunger. They are starving. Euromed Human Rights said that it had documented numerous deaths from starvation, including infants. Mixing animal feed into bread has already started to have adverse effects on people's health. However, despite this, families say they have no other alternative. Abu Anas, a local who lives near a mill, said that any food available in Gaza is no longer affordable, particularly after nearly all bakeries and supermarkets in the Gaza Strip have been bombed. Instead, families are using Stone Age techniques and makeshift ovens to make food and, if they have the means, sell it. Gaza residents are also pumping water from wells and mixing seawater and wastewater amid a shortage of clean water. Jaber, another local in Gaza, says that even if the taste is bad, he and others are mixing different types of flour and ingredients to make bread. He said, "Sometimes the bread is made and it comes out red and yellow because of the ingredients mixed in it," adding that this is not healthy. Ground barley and corn are also being mixed into the flour. In some cases, Palestinians have been forced to trawl through the ground to find scraps of food. Sabrin Al-Atani, 32, evacuated her house in Beit Lahia weeks ago after the Zionist regime airstrikes reduced it to rubble. She and her four children have been grappling with displacement and famine. She told MEE, "I feel helpless as I can't provide my children with food. Lentils and rice have become dreams for us. To survive, like hundreds of thousands in the north, she has had to purchase animal fodder to mix it with wheat for baking bread." Next to Sabrin, her children, Ramadan and Muhammad, aged 9 and 11, expressed their struggle. Muhammad said, the animal fodder in the bread is very bad. The water is polluted. My stomach hurts. We drink water from a well. It doesn't taste good. Mazen Al-Tarek, 50, said the situation has now become critical. He said, "We have stopped differentiating between donkey food and human food. We are eating anything, and no one is helping us. We call on all countries around the world to stand with us, because we can't find food." He added, "We haven't had access to pure white flour for 3 months now, since October 9th, when Israel imposed the full siege. People are picking things up from the flour to eat them. Any flour that can be found is for around 700 shekels. According to Tarek, before the war, a 50-kilogram bag of flour only cost 100 shekels. The residents in Gaza say that using animal fodder in their bread, as well as certain other ingredients, has harmed their health in addition to the lack of clean water and sanitation facilities. Tarek said, "All of my children have stomach pains and diarrhea because of the food, water, and rubbish in the streets. We are all ill now in Gaza. No one is feeling what we are going through." Likewise, Khaled Rasem, a 25-year-old resident of Jabalia camp, told Middle East Eye that necessities such as baby food and supplements are missing. He said, "Food is almost non-existent. Medicine is only available in few places, and the hospitals are not fully functioning." Bazaar.
If you look around, nearly every object you see is made of raw material extracted from a mine. Basically, if you can't grow it, you have to mine it. The extraction of minerals, metals, and fuels from the ground is one of humankind's oldest industries. Never more than now has society been so dependent on greater variety and larger volumes of mined products. So it's no surprise that mining fuels our modern world and makes economies grow. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Alireza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we will be exploring the mining industry while shining the spotlight on the machinery used in this sector. We wanted to see what types of machines are used and who is actively manufacturing them. Plus, we wanted to understand why the mining sector is crucial to the national economy and how manufacturers contribute to its progress. So, let's roll out the show. Our quest for answers led us to Shahrud city in Semnan province, where we visited a company specializing in manufacturing various mining machines. With nearly 20 years of experience, this knowledge-based company is active in a host of fields. It conducts research, development, and production of equipment needed in various industries. That being said, it also manufactures a variety of excavating, drilling, trenching, and digging machines. The life of any product begins in the design room. This company has researched and developed these machines and has perfected their performance. Optimizing the machine's size, speed, and power to carry out tasks has also reduced the expenses related to projects where these machines are used. These machines can be used in agriculture and road maintenance, among other medium-scale construction projects. Most materials needed to make these machines can be purchased inside Iran. Steel sheets, gears, wires, and whatever else is required to build the machine can be domestically found. And if a design requires a particular part, this company can make its own molds to create the parts. You might find it interesting that these machines are currently imported as there is a high demand among mining companies for equipment. So indigenizing the production of mining machines has been a big step towards supporting this sector. Another benefit to local production is it saves the country millions by cutting back on imports. The beating heart of this knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here is where all the magic happens. This area employs some of the most talented and experienced specialists to research, design products, and optimize existing ones. But that's not all. The research and development department also studies future projects. This company also dabbles in making equipment used to harness renewable energy. This company not only uses its own expert staff, but also stays up to date on the latest knowledge by maintaining links with the Industrial University of Shahrud. It collaborates with academic institutions and exchanges knowledge with them too. Furthermore, this knowledge firm also uses capacities and resources made available by Semnon Tech Park. Among its services, it offers the execution of projects through contracting. For example, it has used its machines to complete piping and installation of telecommunications manholes for intercity networks. Another example is carving drainage systems in agricultural fields using its trenchers. Over the years, this company has made a variety of award-winning machines, such as drilling machines equipped with fiber optic lights. Moreover, this company has invented 6 products that have been internationally patented. This knowledge-based manufacturer has never stopped eyeing the future and has plans to expand its production units and product portfolio in the coming years. The company we just mentioned is part of the puzzle that helps Iran's mining sector thrive. It is one of Iran's key industries as the country is one of the top 10 mineral-rich nations globally. Roughly 7% of global mineral reserves can be found in Iran, making it one of the most important mineral producers in the world. Numbers from Iran's Trade Promotion Organization show that last year the sector saw a growth in exports. Government officials, however, say export figures could still be much higher. Furthermore, efforts have been placed on encouraging research and production in knowledge-based firms to increase specialized production, such as mining machines, in the market. And here is where knowledge-based companies play a big role. Okay, time for me to take a little break from here and divert your attention to a report that I made earlier in the week. Welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. Today, we are discussing energy production, specifically electricity production through gas turbines and some of the problems that come with it. So, at different times of the year, mainly during the summer, we get sporadic blackouts at peak hours, at one of the peak hours, let's say around 12 at noon until 4 to 5 p.m. Because we cannot store electricity, electricity production must always match electricity consumption. But because of the temperature during these hours, during this time of the year, during the summer, temperature, high temperatures in particular, negatively affect electricity production through gas turbines. So first we're going to take a look at, well, why that is and how gas turbines work. And also, we believe that we have found a solution at Sharif Innovation Center in one of the companies that has made that solution, and we're going to check that out too. Thank you. Why do high temperatures negatively affect the performance of a gas turbine? Well, bear with me as I try to explain how a gas turbine works through this prototype that they have here. This is the prototype of the device that would be used at scale. This is not at scale. So imagine this is the gas turbine. How it works is that it sucks air through these air ducts, and the temperature of that air is very important. I'm going to get back to that. The air goes through a compressor here. The compressor compresses the air, which we would need the compressed air for the combustion chamber. A combustion chamber essentially makes this work exactly like a plane engine or a car engine. A car engine is slightly different because the movement that it produces is linear, whereas the plane engine has rotary movement. So that's exactly what it is like because it produces rotary movement. So in the combustion chamber, we add a certain type of gas to the compressed air, and then a little spark creates an explosion, and the explosion, the high pressure air, would then spin our turbines. And the turbines, which have movement in them, are connected to a generator, and the generator's job is to turn movement into electricity, which goes through the power grid and then gets to whoever needs it. Now, the thing here, the important thing about the air temperature is that we need ideal conditions, ideally, for the machine to work at peak performance. And that ideal condition is at sea level 15 degrees Celsius. So the air, ideally, is 15 degrees Celsius. But we don't get that kind of temperature in a lot of places, especially in a hot and dry climate. So we have a couple of options to alleviate that problem. Number one, the inefficient option is to work the compressor a lot more, which would use a lot more energy, but that's not even the issue. The issue is that there's a lot easier of a way. So what they have found at TEPCO company is that they have instead tried to use an ice storage unit to work as a thermal storage compartment, because the thermal storage capacity of ice is 100 times more than that of the water. So here they create ice essentially at midnight until the morning when no one is using the power and the air is colder, because that is what happens. The difference between temperatures during the day and temperatures during the night in dry climates is pretty massive. So it's a lot easier to create the ice during that time. So they do that so that in the morning or at noon during peak hours, 12 p.m. to like 4 or 5 p.m., they have the ice to cool the water that is in the storage, and the cooled water goes through a radiator behind the air duct so that the air, the probably hot air that comes through the chamber, is cooled using the water that is in the ice storage compartment. That water cools the air down to like 15 degrees and gives us ideal conditions to work with. So the compressor doesn't need to work that hard. We get our ideal conditions through the ice storage unit. And that is how they are able to offset the amount of electricity that we would lose if we were to use the compressor a lot harder. And that's pretty much how a gas turbine works as well, but also this is the innovation here. A better way to cool the air and get a gas turbine to work at peak performance. There are other less efficient methods of cooling the water that comes through the chamber. Both of them are called evaporative cooling. The first type is done through a wet media, most likely a cooling pad that you see in water coolers everywhere. So how it works is that there is a lot of surface and they run water through it, and the air is going to go through this cooling pad. So as the air goes through the cooling pad, the water absorbs the heat from the air and evaporates. Evaporation is an endothermic procedure, which is heat absorbing, which means that the heat is absorbed from the air and transferred to the water, which evaporates, making the air that runs through the cooling pad a lot cooler. This is a rather wasteful method because, well, you're using water, because In the method that I showed you, you don't use water. The water is just circulated back into the system. This one, you use water, and it's just generally not that efficient. The other method is even more inefficient. You see it's in a lot of places in like outdoors restaurants. They spray water through the air that is going to go through the chamber, and the extremely tiny water droplets absorb the heat from the air and evaporate as they are sprayed. This also absorbs heat from the air, and that is why when you go through the spray of water, you feel a cool breeze, because the air is a lot cooler, because its heat is transferred to the water molecules. So both of these methods are pretty inefficient, and I just wanted you to note about other methods that are used, but they are definitely more inefficient. And the chart is a demonstration of how our thermal storage system would perform in an actual 400 megawatt hour power plant system. When the ice is getting used during in midday, it bumps up the production by a difference of 60 megawatts in a regular 400 megawatt hour power plant. All right, now it's time for me to take a little break here and hand it over to my good friend out in the field who's prepared a report for us.
In ancient Iran, felt was already used in the production of numerous kinds of clothing, bed clothes, floor carpets, and different kinds of sacks. In fact, the Iranian world may have been an important center for the development of felt technology. In the modern world today, felt or namat has found its way to industries of all kinds in various forms.
You just can't imagine how crowded this place is. Whenever I want to talk on the phone, I have to find a sign-up place to be able to talk to you. It's really crazy. God, in today's chaotic society, stress is an issue that many of us suffer from every day. But what matters most is trying to find the stress sources and try to find effective solutions. For this reason, today I'm here to tell you that I finally found a startup, a new innovative company that has finally found a solution to this disastrous problem. I won't tell you any further. Let's just go and check it out.
Felt, or so-called namat, is the acoustic solution for rowdy places to absorb and decrease undesirable noises. The aim is to provide sound serenity and to improve physical, mental, and psychological health. Namat Studio's scope of work is based on designing and manufacturing products. Recently, it has also played a significant role in different projects like some innovation centers in Asia and Africa. This company has focused on designing and building acoustic products. Generally in Iran, there is no specific competitor in this field. However, there are some groups in America and Northern Europe that are engaged with felt.
If I want to tell you about a history about how our company established, it goes back to 3 years ago when Diva was chosen to renovate the innovation factory of Iran, that was the biggest one in the time. And the designer tried to make the offices and they tried to design a place that the people be comfortable, have a good place to work. That's why we understand that we have some advantages and disadvantages. One of these disadvantages is about the sound pollution that we had in the this area, that places were noisy and the employees didn't like that. That's why we try to use special materials for control this sound pollution. And we reached the felt material and we try to use this material.
Designing acoustic and movable working stations with the aim of recycling old products and reuse them in different functions. What is worth noticing about this business is the fact that the problem-solution method is based upon three WH questions: why, how, and what. Why is to define the problem, how is the process towards the solution, and what is the final product and prototype. These acoustic solutions were combined with architecture in various parts of the space and played the role in sound insulation and creating a silent space.
All right, now I want to walk you through some of the major products that are made of felt. The first piece we have here is an artwork that is made of wool felt that acts as a sound-absorbing material, not only as an aesthetic material that you can put it in your home place, but also as a sound-absorbing material. There is this phone booth. If I get inside, I can feel the private space and how the atmosphere really changes. It improves the acoustic vibes and reduces the reverberation when I get inside. And there's this whole thing, we call it desk divider. It's actually one of the main products in this company. People and employees put it in their on their desk to divide their own workplace with the person right next to them.
We have three different kind of material that we use on our works that absorb undesirable sounds, which are wool panels, or the other name is felt, and in Persian we say namat, and thermofelt and carpet. And the felt are in two kind of industrial felt and the natural felt. Natural felt is made by wools, and industrial material is made by a process by the battles and pet materials. They have different color patterns and thicknesses. The thicknesses are from 3 millimeter to 50 millimeter. And about the thermofelt, we have this material that we can use for more absorption. It has three kind of material with polyester, jeans, and heavy traffic, and it's very good for absorbing. And the last one is the carpet that is heavy traffic that we use in heavy traffic places such as the offices, and it can be cleaned very easy by the vacuum cleaner.
As I mentioned earlier, this idea was created based on the concept of recreating, recycling, and revitalizing the surrounding substances and generalizing this idea to the upcoming products with different potentials. Such small-scale products are intended to improve the mental and physical health of users. And finally, creating a comfortable, inviting atmosphere.
Just like this linear lighting, almost everything here is made of felt. Based on environmental psychology, this linear lighting has been created in a way to provide maximum visual and acoustic comfort in the workplace, especially a co-working space like this. This company, Namad Startup, has been trying to promote sustainability and also take steps towards industrialization. Among all the products here, there were so many things, but I decided to choose felt laptop case to carry my laptop with me wherever I go. So it's not about the ideas, it's about making the ideas happen. I've been Sarah Dema.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for tuning in. It's bye for now.
IRIB English Radio.